Just a short vignette before getting started. I've, Baruch Hashem, in the last few years, had the opportunity to come back to Chicago. I say back to Chicago, because I have some very, very fond old memories from here. To stay with Caleb's family for Shabbat. And the very first time I came, which was, I think, 3 years ago, I came in Friday morning, and I came in Friday at noon, right after school, and the first thing was, Caleb said, can you help me with this Malbim? So the first interaction that we had, at least here in Illinois, was to sit and learn Torah together. So it's really been a delight over these past few weeks to learn Torah together and have a few people eavesdrop. Over the last couple of weeks, we've looked at the relationship between Yaakov and Esav. The first week, from the perspective of how it's told in Sefer Bereishit itself, and then last week, you looked at how that relationship develops further through the Tanakh. We're now going to look at what becomes really the eternal definition of that relationship, and that is the way that the Midrash portrays it. But critical to understand, to bridge the gap between Bereishit and the Midrash, is that, and I know this might sound strange at first blush, we have to understand that Tanakh also operates as Midrash. Let me give you one example, maybe perhaps two examples, and then bring it back home to our topic. You ask the average person on the street, why wasn't David allowed to build the Beit HaMikdash? What will their answer be? Well, it really depends on what street you're on. Most streets, they'll ask you, what's a David and what's a Beit HaMikdash? But the average educated Jew will say, why? He had blood on his hands. Say, oh, very interesting. I'd like to learn about that. So I open up, say, for Shmuel, where the topic happens, in Shmuel Bet Perek Zion. I open up, say, for Melachim, where Shlomo reports about his father's inability to build, and several times, and I never find a mention of blood on the hands. I find that in the first instance in Shmuel Bet Perek Zion, Hashem tells David, you want to build a house for me? First I'll build a house for you, which would mean you're going to die and your son will take over and he'll build the house. And you take a look at Malachim, and it seems clear that the reason David cannot build the house, as Shlomo reports to Hiram when he asks for Hiram's cooperation in building the Mikdash, is that David was occupied with other things. Where do we find a mention of David not being able to build the Mikdash because of blood on his hands? It's Sefer Divrei Hayamim. It's the first time it's mentioned. And Divrei Hayamim, as we all understand, and as Chazal tell us, is a chronicle of the, really, of the house of David, essentially. It was composed during Bayit Sheni times, during Second Temple to period. So how are we to read it when all of the evidence from the period texts, from Shmuel and Malachim, indicate that David's inability to build the Beit HaMikdash was due to other considerations? We open up Divrei Hayamim and suddenly we find Dam LaRov Shafachta, that David says to Shlomo in Divrei Hayamim, you must build the house, God will not let me build the house because he's told me that I've spilled lots of blood. Yadecha damim maleu. Is that referring to David as a warrior? Is it referring to the story of Uriah Hiti? Unclear. So how are we to reconcile these reasons? And there are essentially two paths which will ultimately coalesce. Path one is more radical. We'll start with that. After all, Sunday morning we could do this. And that is to say that Divrei Hayamim is purely Midrash. Midrash meaning that it is not reporting accurately what happened at the time. It is taking the events of the time and adding in a whole new message. Then you got to ask, what would be the purpose of that? And the answer is actually quite clear when we study the period of Divrei Hayamim. What happened when Bnei Yisrael were exiled to Babel? Not long afterwards, that exile was overturned in the person of Koresh, Cyrus, who in Yishayahu Mem Hei is called God's Mashiach. And he announces that anyone who would like to go back to Yerushalayim and build the Mikdash, here is money, here's materials, here's animals to bring as a korban, you're free to go, go. We went in very small numbers, and it was all only the lowest class of Jews who actually left. Everybody else stayed in Babel. Part of the motivation of the author of Divrei HaYamim, as evidenced by numerous things in the text, is to highlight the sanctity of Yerushalayim and the sanctity of the Beit HaMikdash. By the way, Divrei HaYamim, speaking about this week's parasha, is the one place where we find an explicit connection between the place of the Beit HaMikdash and a place called Moriah, the place of the Akedah. That only appears in Divrei HaYamim. So one can easily argue, and it's not my argument, it's an argument that's made for hundreds of years already, that the author of Divrei HaYamim is trying to highlight the special Kedusha of Yerushalayim and the Beit HaMikdash, and as a result, one of the items he says is that even someone as great and storied as David HaMelech was not allowed to build this Beit HaMikdash because of the blood on his hands. That's one way to take it. Which would mean that the report in Divrei HaYamim is not an accurate period report of what was going on, but is an opportunity to teach an important lesson for the current audience of Divrei HaYamim, building on history. There's yet a second approach, an approach that perhaps we're a lot more comfortable with, which is to say that David was not allowed to build the Beit HaMikdash for a number of reasons. Some of the reasons are explicated in Sefer Shmuel and in Sefer Melachim, and others are explicated in Divrei HaYamim. And by the way, we take pretty much the same approach to Midrash. When we read a Midrash that presents something different than the text, how do we read it? Do we read it as saying that really the text is what the text is, and the times of the Midrash, the authors of the Midrash are interested in highlighting an additional lesson, and they squeeze it out of the text, as it were? Or do we say that what the text says is only part of the story, and the Midrash is filling in the rest of the story? And the reality is that both approaches are accurate. And the answer to which approach to use is the best answer that any rabbi can give to the toughest question. What's the one-word answer that's almost always accurate to a tough question? Depends. Rabbi, I was cooking chicken soup, and my kid's ice cream cone got nearby and some dripped in. Is it kosher? And the answer has got to be, it depends. Was it already boiling? How much ice cream? How much chicken? And the same thing happens here. There are certainly cases where Midrashim, or later books of Tanakh even, are highlighting new information, meaning information that was accurate at the time, and giving a new perspective. And there are certainly times when the Midrash is adding in information that was not true at the time. Let me give you a small example of this, of the second. Someone who is certainly part of this shiur is a fellow named Haman. Talk about Esav. Haman is presented in Midrashic literature as a descendant of Amalek. Something that, as we saw last week in the shiur, is actually impossible, because the text makes it very clear that the last remnant of Amalek was destroyed in the times of Chizkiyahu. Okay? And we'll actually get back to that connection later on. In Haman's famous speech to Ahasuerus, in which he asks Ahasuerus to okay the destruction of a particular nation. By the way, in that text, he never mentions who the nation is, and if you look very carefully, he doesn't even ask for that nation to be destroyed. He just asks to be able to disappear them. In the Midrashic development of that speech, Haman says to Ahasuerus very explicitly, it's the Jewish people, and on the Pasuk, Datehem shonot mikol am, that datei hamelech enam osim. They have different customs than everyone else, and they do not follow the king's traditions or the king's customs. The Midrash has Haman very explicitly saying, Datehem shonot mikol am, which means they are always saying, this is to quote Rava, they're always saying, Shahi Pahi. What's Shahi Pahi? Something that I haven't said too often lately. Shabbat Hayom Pesach Hayom. In other words, it's always a Jewish holiday. I can't work. I can't open my store. I can't sell anything to you because it's a Jewish holiday. It's Shabbos. It's Pesach. But in a later version of that Midrash, the Shai Pai gets expanded. It's delightful. Haman pulls out the Ezra's Torah Luach. And he says, every week they've got Shabbos. Every month they've got Rosh Chodesh. In Nisan they got Pesach. And you can know where Haman's politics are because the next thing he goes to is Shavuot. You know what he skips. He says they have Shavuot. Then they have Rosh Hashanah. Then they have Yom Kippur. Then they have Sukkot. They've got lots of holidays. And the king turns back to him and says, that's their religion. In Persia, we allow people to practice their own religion. So what's the second half of the pasuk? They don't practice your holidays. And listen to what the Midrash, a later Midrash, a 9th century Midrash, has Haman saying. He said, sure, if they would keep their holidays and also celebrate Kalenda and Saturnalia, I wouldn't mind. But they don't celebrate that either. Now, it's interesting that Kalenda and Saturnalia are two Greek holidays that were adopted by the Romans. Kalenda, you may be familiar with. It's January 1st. That's where we get the word calendar from. And Saturnalia, of course, is the famous winter, beginning of winter solstice holiday, which is Mithras, is the Wikibus, which is the day of the Dies Natali, sorry, the day of the birth of the invincible sun, which, by the way, a day that later becomes Christmas, around the solstice. You got to wonder, why is Haman, a 5th century BCE Persian, angry at the Jews for not keeping Roman holidays? None of this makes any sense. Until we find out about the attitudes of the Romans towards the Jews. So let's step back 1 second before finishing with this Midrash. Have you ever heard of anti-Semitic canards? Have you ever heard them? Have you ever been personally subject to an anti-Semitic epithet? Even if it's dual loyalties. You have. I once had a kid in Northern California feel my head. And 30 miles later down the road, I realized he was checking for horns. We're all familiar with them. One thing I've never heard us being accused of is being lazy. Pushy, controlling, yeah. Lazy I never heard. And suddenly Haman is accusing us of being lazy and taking all these holidays off. Doesn't make any sense until you find that in the Roman era, that was actually an accusation leveled against the Jews. In one of his satires, Juvenal says the following, the Jew made up a holiday where once a week he doesn't work at all. And he liked it so much that he decided to make a whole year out of it. And that's how he says Shemitah came about. Now, of course, it's silly to us. But that's what they were saying. So I now understand that Haman's claim that we are lazy and Haman's complaint that we're not celebrating Saturnalia and Kalenda is not Haman. It's the anti-Semite in the 3rd or 4th or 5th century in the Roman era, Empire. And what we've done effectively is to take Haman's voice and put into it the current anti-Semitic canards. And so we definitely do have Midrashim in which we're not going to say the Midrash is claiming to, or we should understand the Midrash as actually telling us what happened in the period of the Tanakh, but rather as sort of updating it, if you will. So there are times when we have to do the Midrash this way and sometimes that way. And again, Midrashim do not start with the Midrashic literature. Midrashim start already in Tanakh. Take a look at some of our haftarot. What about Torah Vayetze, where we have a description of Yaakov and Esav's relationship? That's already giving a midrashic description to the events that took place in Bereshit. A quick introduction to Midrash itself. Perhaps one of the worst things that a person, or parent specifically, can utter. We have several sayings that are common and really bad. One of them is, it's just a minig. The other one is, it's just a medrash. It's a terrible statement. Yeah, I don't think it's just a medrash. What are midrashim? So let's start with the basics. What does the word lidrosh mean? What's lidrosh? What does the word mean? Lidrosh. Lidrosh means to seek. To seek. How do we say regards in Hebrew? Send regards. Timsor, dash. Dash is short for Drishat Shalom. What does Drishat Shalom mean? We get it from Yaakov's words actually to Yosef on that fateful journey. Drosh et shlomachecha. And to Yishai's words to David when he goes to the camp. Seek out the peace of your brothers. Which means find out how they're doing and report back to me. Seek out, find out. To be engaged in Midrash means to look into psukim and to try to find more meaning, more lessons, more applications. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's the original intent of the text, but I can identify a critical, valuable lesson in these words. Most of the body of Midrash that we have is actually in collections that are collections of Midrash. Midrash Rabbah, Midrash Tanhuma, later collections. And these Midrashim were presented orally, almost all of them in Eretz Yisrael, almost all of them somewhere between the 4th and the 9th centuries. And a Darshan would get up typically before Kriyat HaTorah, before the reading of one of the Megillot, and would expound on a particular phrase, a particular text in the what's about to be read, and draw out a contemporary lesson. Does that sound familiar? That's what happens here every Shabbat morning. Rabbi Gelman, that's what Rabbi Engel does every Shabbat morning at our Torah. A Midrash is taking the text that we're about to read, or any other text from Tanakh, and finding and bringing out new lessons from that text. If the lessons resonate with the audience, it becomes a popular midrash. And gets repeated. And gets repeated enough that finally at one point somebody publishes it. And it has legs. It lasts. And the midrashim that we have in our collections of midrashim are the midrashim that last, because they resonate with the audience. Midrashim about Yaakov and Esav have tremendous staying power, because they really speak to the audiences in the Batei Knesset in Eretz Yisrael, especially during that period. But how did that happen? So if you recall last week, we saw that Esav develops quite naturally into Edom. The text tells us that Esav hu Edom, and that Esav moved to that area, took over the land from Hachori, and became Edom. And so the events that happen with the tribe, the clan, the nation of Edom later on are the events of Esav, and a fulfillment in one manner or another of that original nevuah that's been driving us all 3 weeks. Shnei goyim bevitnechu, shnei l'umim mimayach yiparedu, ulo'om milo'om yamatz rav yavod seir. Here's where the break happens. What is the general halachic attitude about ethnicities in Chumash? We have a whole bunch of ethnicities in Chumash. We have 7 nations in the land. We have Ammon and Moab, that we have particular commands regarding them. We have Amalek, we have particular commands regarding him. We have Mitzrayim with particular commands. I'm not talking about the location, but the ethnicity. The halacha is very clear. Kvar amad sancheriv ubilbel ataumot. It's a Tosefta in Yadayim. It's quoted all over Shas. And it's Nifsak al-Halacha, the Rambam in Hilchot Malachim. is that with all of the wars that took place in the Middle East during the first millennium BCE, there are no more nations. Everybody's basically a mutt. And therefore, we don't know what nation you're from, and therefore all these halachot don't apply. The Rambam says it in three very quick words. Ukvar avad zichram. Their memory is lost. So what do we do with Esav? Because we have a nevuah that the relationship between Esav and Yaakov is going to last forever. So let's take a look at how Esav develops in the Midrash. Source number one is a very famous Midrash in the Sifri. It's actually Midrash Halacha, but in the middle there's this Agadah that I put in big print. And in this Midrash has been utilized certainly over the last few centuries. We have records of rabbinic sermons that have utilized this particular phrase. It was very popular, by the way, in the 1930s and 40s for a reason that should be very obvious. The Midrash is picking up off of a dot. There are particular words in Chumash that, according to the Masorah, according to the tradition of how to write a Sefer Torah, have to have dots on them. And this is in Balotcha because there happens to be a dot over the hay of Rechoka about Pesach Sheni. And so then the Midrash talks about other dots. You may have noticed yesterday at Mincha, if anybody here leaned Mincha yesterday, you may have noticed that on Ayesara Ishtecha, that there's dots over that word. Vimri Lav. Kayotsebo. Similarly, when Yaakov and Esav reunite, said Vayin Shakehu, Esav kisses Yaakov, which we read as, and 2 weeks ago we read as being a beautiful closing of the circle. Nakud alav shalom neshako b'chol libo. Why is there a dot on Vayishakehu? To tell you, he wasn't kissing him with all of his heart. He was at least, at the very least, conflicted. And of course we have Midrashim that go much further. What are the Midrashim we all grew up with in school? That when Esav was kissing Yaakov, what is he really doing? He wanted to bite his neck, right? Funny, it was daytime, I don't know. Anyhow, and what happened? Yaakov's neck became stone, which, by the way, is parallel to another Midrash about whom? When Moshe Rabbeinu killed the Egyptian, Paro wanted to kill him. He was going to kill him, and his neck turned to stone, so he couldn't kill him, then Moshe ran away. Right? These Midrashim working on a common theme. According to that Midrash I just mentioned, what was Esav's attitude towards Yaakov? Continued hatred and wanting to kill him. Doesn't work with the rest of the Psukim, but for the purpose of the Midrash, we'll ignore that. Because we want Esav to become somebody else than he is in Bereishit. According to this Midrash, what happened? Esav kissed Yaakov, but not with all of his heart. He was conflicted. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai comes along and says the following. In most of our texts, it reads, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai omer, halacha biyadua she'esav sonei le'Yaakov. The word halacha is very bizarre. And in Horowitz's critical edition of the Sifri, he actually says the proper word is halo, based on all the manuscripts. In any case, halo biyadua she'esav sonei le'Yaakov. We know that Esav hates Yaakov. Notice, it's not sane in the past tense, but sone in the present tense. He disagrees, and he says the dot is not there to teach that Esav kissed with conflicted feelings. He actually kissed Yaakov with full love for his brother, because his compassion at that moment overcame his inborn and eternal hatred for Yaakov. Now, what are they talking about here? To put it as I always ask my guys in my Gemara shiur, the bottom line question of every discussion in the Gemara is two important words, which is, who cares? But notice that Esav and Yaakov here are in the present tense. So if we can somehow find a descendant of Esav who carries that same attitude towards Yaakov, we'll know. Has he made peace with Yaakov? Is he conflicted? Or is he still absolutely seething with hatred? Three different approaches. But of course, Esav is long dead, so how does that happen? One more piece about this, which is interesting about the hatred of Esav to Yaakov. David, numerous times in Sefer Tehillim, talks about how he's got so many enemies around him, people want to kill him. Take a look, for instance, at Hashem Orivi Yishi, Al Tineni Benefesh Sarai, don't allow me to go into the throat of my enemies. And then Perakafe says, Re'ei Oivai, some people perhaps say Perakafe for Tachanun, Nusach Sfard, Re'ei Oivai Kirabu, B'sinat Chamas Sineuni, they hate me with this violent hatred. And then David says in the Midrash, Im Esav Sonei Yaakov, and look how he says it. Esav hates Yaakov, sure, Yaakov stole the Bechorah from him. Vadinimo. And really, Esav was right. But what did I do to all these people? Barbarim, by the way. Interesting. These barbaric people. And now the Midrash changes the word from Hamas to Chinam. Sinat Chinam Sineuni. Chacham Arei Vaikirabu. In this Midrash and many other Midrashim, Esav's hatred for Yaakov is actually justified. It says at least in that case, Yaakov did something to him. But these people are hating me for no reason. In other words, they're worse than Esav. But who are all these people? And here we really get to the big speed bump in the road. It's not a speed bump, it's a wall. It's a wall with barbed wire on it. How do we get from Esav in Bereshit, Esav in Dvarim, Esav even in Malachi and in Ovadia and in Yirmiyahu, and the critical pasuk in Amos that we're going to go back to? How do we get from that to Esav today? Esav's gone. So why are these midrashim still cooking? Why are we still talking about Esav? It starts in the second century. And we can actually pinpoint who started it. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Loi. Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Loi was one of the illustrious older students of Rabbi Akiva. Remember the story. Rabbi Akiva had thousands of students. And they were all decimated at one point. At some point, perhaps, we'll talk about what that's about, the history behind that, the background of that plague, as it were. And Rabbi Akiva did not give up. Rabbi Akiva was not personally destroyed by the destruction of all of his students. And he went and found older students, accomplished rabbis who became his students. Who were they? Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon. By the way, you know Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who was just quoted as saying, Esav Sonei LeYaakov. Keep this in mind. And several others. There's a machloket about who the others are. But those four, who are the four most common names in the Mishnah, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yehuda, are all students of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva's later years. Important to note, Rabbi Akiva's later years are Bar Kochba and after Bar Kochba, and Rabbi Akiva is killed, which means not that long. I'm reviewed Rabbi Loi. Rabbi Hayadoresh. Who's Rabbi? Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Loi is my Rabbi. My Rabbi would teach. And this very famous pasuk that we saw 2 weeks ago. What is it Yitzchak exclaims when Yaakov comes to him? And Yitzchak can't see? Hakol, kol, Yaakov, v'yadayim yedei Esav. How do we translate that? Hakol, kol, Yaakov. The voice is the voice of Yaakov. V'hayadayim yedei Esav. What's the vav? How do you translate that vav? But. It's what we call vav hanigud. And there's actually many, many, many examples of it in Tanakh. Lo hameitim yahaluluya v'lo kol yodei duma v'anachnu nevarech yah. They won't praise you, but we will. Hakol kol Yaakov, but hayadayim yedei Esav. And I'm confused. Who is this? Rabbi Akiva darshan it differently. Hakol kol Yaakov, meaning kol Yaakov matzviach mimasha asulo hayadayim yedei Esav. Now this is clearly not contextually accurate. It's not Yaakov talking, it's Yitzchak talking. And Yitzchak talking about his confusion. But what's the drasha on this phrase? The voice of Yaakov is screaming because of what the hands of Esav have done to him. Now by the way, at that point in the narrative, or at any point in the narrative, what did the hands of Esav do to Yaakov? Nothing, except maybe this. Nothing. So we're not talking about Yaakov and Esav anymore. Who are we talking about? So Rabbi Yochanan, a couple generations later, adds a bit. Whose voice is this? And he turns it inside out. Kol Adrianus Shachik Atzamot. They made fun of Hadrian and called him a necromancer. Horeg beveitar shmonim elef ribo b'nei adam. So what's it the sound of? It's the sound of the massacre in Beitar that the Romans effected. The hands of the Romans slaughtering Jews and the Jews screaming, Hakol kol Yaakov because of the Adami de Esav. Well, I get that we are Yaakov. But how did Hadrian become Esav? Just a note about Beitar, just so we're all on the same page. Chazal tell us in Masachat Tanit that five terrible things happened to us on Shivasa B'Tammuz, and five really terrible things happened to us on Tisha B'Av. The five things that happened on Tisha B'Av were two Batei Mikdash being destroyed, but before that, the Meraglim, and that at a later point in history, the Beit HaMikdash was flattened, Har Bayit was flattened, because you have to remember, on Tisha B'Av, the year 70, they burned the Mikdash. I got news for you. You can't burn stone very well. So what was left after Tisha B'Av? A building. But a building that was burned out. You know the story that Rabbi Kiva and his colleagues came to look from a distance. And what did they see? A fox running out of where? Beit Kodesh HaKodeshim. The building was still there. After Bar Kokhba's rebellion was quashed, the Romans then flattened the city. They flattened the mountain. It remained that way until the Muslims came. But item number four on the list is perhaps the one that was the most tragic, which is Nilkedah Beitar. In the year 132, 62 years after the destruction, a guerrilla leader by the name of Shimon Bar Kospa began a rebellion against the Romans. And it was such a popular rebellion that estimates are that one-third of the available young Jewish men in Israel signed up for his army, which is quite a thing for an underground militia. Perhaps even more. This rebellion was so successful that there ended up more Roman soldiers in Palestine than anywhere else in the world, including Rome. The entire 22nd Legion of the Roman army was decimated, so much so that they never reconstituted it. Bar Kokhba and his men were very successful. We'll talk about his name in a minute. And for 3 years, this group of rebels issued coins. Some of you must have seen some Bar Kokhba coins. And what do they say? Shana Aleph Ligulat Yisrael, Shana Bet Ligulat Yisrael, Shana Gimel Ligulat Yisrael. The first, second, third year of the redemption of Israel. There is no Shana Dalad. Because in the summer of 135, the Roman armies came, found, and infiltrated Bar Kokhba's fort at Beitar. And there was a massacre so terrible that Chazal tell us that the land of Israel was filled with blood of the soldiers, so much so that the people were able to actually irrigate their fields with that blood. Terrible description. Terrifying description. And here Rabbi Yochanan says, that's what HaKol Kol Yaakov is, Adayim De Esav, meaning the hands of Esav have done this to Yaakov, but now we have the big leap to make. How do we get from Esav to Rome? Surely one of the most difficult characters to decipher in Chumash is a character named Bilam. And in Bilam's first of his three great poems, he says, "Erenu v'lo ata, Sherenu v'lo karov." Sorry, this is the last one. "Sherenu v'lo karov." He says, "Darach kochav mi Yaakov." A star will shoot forth from Yaakov in this prophecy. "V'kam shevet mi Yisrael." A staff will come up. He's going to attack and destroy the enemies nearby. And then, Vahaya Edom Yeresha. And they will inherit Edom. So there's a nevuah that somebody is going to come forth out of Yaakov as a star. He's going to lead an army and they're going to attack and decimate Edom. That never happened up until the time of the destruction of the second Mikdash. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Our same Rabbi Yochanan says, Karhave Chazi Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Akiva would see Leven Kozba. The leader of that rebellion was a fellow named Shimon Bar Kozba. We know it, we have letters he signed. When Rabbi Akiva would see him, Have Amar Darach Kochav Miyakov, he would see him and he would say the Pasuk, Darach Kochav Miyakov. This one is the star shooting forth out of Yaakov. Promised in the Nevuah Bilam. Which means, what's he going to do? He's going to lead Am Yisrael to victory, especially over Edom. Edom is gone. So who is Edom? Edom becomes Rome. That's Rabbi Akiva. Starts with Rabbi Akiva. And from Rabbi Akiva onwards, you could see one of his students immediately interprets Hakol Kol Yaakov. He quotes Rabbi Akiva saying it. By the way, Rabbi Akiva was all alone in this. His colleagues thought he was wrong. His colleagues' approach is expressed by Rabbi Yochanan ben Tortas, who was a relatively unknown rabbi, relatively to the ones we're familiar with, but he said, Akiva ya'alu eis asavim bil chayecha v'adayin ben David loba. You will be dead and buried, and Mashiach still won't have come. In other words, you're wrong about this Bar Kochba. Why did Rabbi Akiva, therefore, that's for Rabbi Akiva, change his name from Bar Kozba to Bar Kochba, Kochba being the star, based on this pasuk? There's a tradition that later on, after he was defeated and proven to be not really a false messiah, but not the one we had hoped for, that they would call him Bar Koziva, which means the son of the lie. It's a play on words. But it doesn't stop with Rabbi Akiva. If you take a look at the Pasuk at the bottom, you will see in Pasuk Zion, this is a nevuah, a prophecy about Edom, in Sefer Yeshayahu, V'yardu re'imim imam. Turn the page and take a look. V'yardu re'imim imam, source 7 in the middle. Amar Rabbi Meir, V'yardu romiim imam. How does he read the word re'imim? Romiim, the Romans. And indeed, Rabbi Meir in the Nevuah in Yeshayahu Chafalef, Yeshayahu has a whole series of Nevuot against the nations. He has one against the nation called Duma. In Rabbi Meir's Sefer Yeshayahu, it said actually Masa Romi. In other words, what Rabbi Meir, a student of Rabbi Akiva, was doing was he was, if you will, updating so that the nation of Edom, the Re'imim of Edom, the Duma of Edom, suddenly becomes Roma. There are those who believe actually that in the Haggadah, we find this almost at the beginning. So let's step back for a second. When was the Haggadah as we have it formulated? The answer is actually still under construction. Haggadah Shel Pesach is something that continues to evolve. I don't know everybody's ages here, but I remember as a kid, we would open the door for Eliyahu and we would sing the Animam in from Bergen-Belsen. 10 years later, we had an empty chair at the table. Anybody remember this? For the Jews in the Soviet Union. 15 years later, we had an empty chair at the table for the Jews in Ethiopia. The Seder is a continually evolving process. But the core text of the Haggadah was developed when? Think about the core text of the, not the Psukim, but the rest of it. When was it developed? Well, who are the names of rabbis you recognize from the Haggadah? Who's in Bnei Brak? Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. It's all in the 50 years after the destruction. Who's the biggest villain in the Haggadah? We say it at the beginning. Lavan ha'arami. Or shall we say, perhaps more appropriately, what they're really trying to say is Lavan ha'romai. It's a lot safer to speak about Lavan ha'arami when the Romans are watching. But wink, wink, we all know who we're talking about. What we find developing from this period on through the Midrashic era is a strong identification of Esav, Edom, to Rome. And the Roman Empire becomes the embodiment of Esav, and the eternal struggle between Esav and Yaakov is now typified by the destruction of the Mikdash, by the oppression of the Romans, and by the promise that ultimately Rav Ya'avod Sa'ir, we will overtake them. Which is why Bar Kochba is such a seminal character in this whole narrative. He's the one who's going to lead that battle that will actually turn at Rav Ya'avod Sa'ir. So we're going to jump ahead in history a little bit. What happens in Rome in the 4th century? The Roman Empire becomes the Holy Roman Empire. A fellow named Constantine converts. So what happens to Esav? In Midrashic literature, Esav goes from the Roman Empire to the Vatican. In Midrashic literature, Esav is the church. Because the church is now Rome. What is this all about? How are they shifting identities? There is a... We're still towards the beginning of Sefer Bereshit in our readings. Reading Sefer Bereshit is a delight. Reading Sefer Bereshit with the Ramban is Olam Haba. Ramban al Torah is always majestic. The Ramban al Torah and Bereshit is just Sfatayim Yishak. And one of the constant tropes in the Ramban, which really begins at the beginning of Lech Lecha, and courses all the way through Bereshit, and picks up in Shmot, is that the events that are presented in Bereshit become a blueprint for all of history. Example, yesterday, Avram picks up, there's a famine, Avram picks up and goes to Egypt, has serious problems with his family as a result. God afflicts Paro with plagues, Avram is enriched, and Avram leaves. He's sent out of the country. And the Ramban says, and therefore the decree was that Avram's children would go to Egypt because of famine, Avram's children would be oppressed, Avram's children would then watch Paro's household become afflicted with plagues, they would become enriched and be sent out of the country. V'chahena v'chahena, through the Ramban. It's just delightful to read the Ramban. Study the Ramban on Bereshit. In what is perhaps the most mysterious scene in all of Sefer Bereshit, and perhaps in all of Chumash, Yaakov is returning from Laban's house for this scary reunion with Esav on his way to come back home. And he sent this huge gift ahead. And then at night, he starts crossing his family across the Yabok. This, by the way, it's a very difficult thing for a man in his 90s. Or anybody. At night, no lights, to climb down an embankment and up an embankment with wives and children and young children. And finally, at the end, he's all alone, and suddenly a guy grabs him and starts wrestling with him. Where does the fellow grab him? He grabs him right around here, yanks his nerve, Gidon Hashem. The Ramban in his commentary on this, take a look at source 11, understands, not like Rashi, that this is Sarosh al Esav, and that it's demonstrating to Yaakov that he'll be able to beat Esav. It's not like the Rashbam, who says that the angel was an emissary of God to keep Yaakov in place and force him to meet Esav, and to not cave into his fear. Look at the Rashbam, it's delightful. The Ramban goes further. Malachav, Gibori Koach, Osei Dvaro, Aken lo yacholo, Malach laziko. A Malach can only do what God lets him do, and therefore the Malach can't hurt Yaakov ultimately. The only thing that God allowed him to do was to pull that nerve. Vamru b'breishit rabbi, quotes the Midrash, Naga b'cholat tzadikim sha'atidim liyot mimeno. Now the Midrash here says that what did this angel do? If you, without being explicit, think about the area of the body where the malach is grabbing, he grabbed all of Yaakov's future generations. Zed Dorosh El Shmad. What's Dorosh El Shmad? Dorosh El Shmad is the period immediately after Bar Kokhba, the time of the terrible persecution. We read about it in Yom Kippur when we read about the Asarah Grim Malchut. We read about it when we read about Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, the last rabbi to ever give smicha, as he gave smicha to a few of his students and then told them to run, and the Romans caught up with him and riddled his body with the swords. because the Romans have made a rule against smicha because of Jewish authority. That generation, that was the generation, by the way, in which the law was formulated. Avor v'alte hareg, violate the law, and you won't be killed. Ya'avor v'al yareg, violate the law. This is the generation in which that had to be formulated, because Jews were giving their lives up for everything. Chutz mi'avodah zarah, gilui arayot shefichut damim, the famous three exceptions. That period, va'inyan ki amorah kulo remez ledorotav, this is the Ramban. This event, this wrestling match, is a hint, an allusion for generations. Sheyed dor bizaro shel Yaakov. There will be a generation in Yaakov's seed. Yitgaber Esav alehem ad sheyeh karov lekakeh beit satan. That Esav, now who's Esav? Esav has become now Rome. Why has Esav become Rome? Because if we have a nivuah that lu'om mila'om ya'amatz, each nation will struggle with the other, that means that until history has concluded, until v'haya Adonai l'melech al kol ha'aretz v'yohi Adonai echad u'shmo echad, that battle must be going on. And if that battle is going on right now between Yaakov and Rome, then Rome is Esav. And we're not making a genealogical claim. Although, by the way, in the 9th century such a claim was made, to try to somehow have Esav, during his life, move to Rome, and therefore become the father of the Romans, and Romulus is actually an anacle of Esav. Such is an attempt to try to make this work genealogically. But all of the evidence of Tanakh has Rome as being the descendants of Yefet, and of course Esav is from Shem, his cousins. Vayaze dor echad mimei chachmei mishnah kedor shel Yehuda ben Baba v'chaverav. It was in that generation. And he describes, read it on your own if you like, he describes in painful detail what the terrible things that happened there. It gets to the point where in the last midrash, Rabbeinu, which very likely is Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, would have to travel to Rome from time to time to plead the case of the Judean province and of the Jews who lived there. Whenever he would go, he would study Parshat Vayishlach. What's Parshat Vayishlach? The reunion of Yaakov and Esav. He would study it like a playbook. He would study it like a strategy. And remember the famous Rashi at the beginning? What did Yaakov do? Three things. You send a gift, you pray, you get ready for war, you got to prepare on all fronts. And the Midrash says one time, if it's Rebbe, whoever this rabbi was, forgot to do so, and by the time he got to Akko to get on the boat, he lost all of his money. The Romans who were accompanying him had stolen stuff from him. Powerful lesson. But it means that interacting with Rome is a continuation of interacting with Esav. Now, parenthetic note, before we bring this to a close and try to understand what's going on, is that we are not the only people with Midrash. You have to remember that part of the tremendous threat of early Christianity was that Christianity was the first instance in history where there was actually a competing religion competing over the same book. The Zoroastrians don't care what it says in Bereshit. They certainly don't care what it says in Isaiah 53. The Greeks didn't care. They cared, they were interested. But they're not going to fight with us over interpretation. True that earlier we had this problem with the Tzedokim, but that played out very differently. And because Christianity essentially started homegrown, although it left pretty quick, Midrash was a style that they were very familiar with. You want to hear something really scary? Read Midrashim, homilies, if you will, of the early church fathers. Esav and Yaakov are still alive. And Esav is being defeated. Because who's Esav? We are. The older one. Who's Yaakov? The younger one. The church. In their homilies, we're Leah and they're Rachel. In their homilies, we are Cain and they're Hevel. I'll agree with the fact that they're Hevel, but The constant theme that courses through Sefer Bereishit of God favoring the younger over the older becomes a flag for the church. So on another level, we can perhaps understand the emphasis in these late Midrashim on accepting that we are Yaakov and Esav, but we still are Yaakov. It's a response to that claim. Many Midrashim that we read are actually in response to claims that we're hearing on the other side of the street. But what is this all about? Ultimately, it's not about a response. Ultimately, it's about an internal lesson. This week, we are reading Parshat Vayera. Parshat Vayera concludes with what I think we would all agree is the most dramatic moment of Abraham's life, probably the most dramatic moment in all of Bereishit, and that is the Akedah. What happened at the Akedah? Well, we don't really know. How much of it was vision, how much was real, we don't know. But the Akedah did not happen. The Akedah continues to happen. In our tradition, in the Ashkenazi tradition, we recite Slichot for a few days before Rosh Hashanah and then for Aseret Yemei Tshuva. What gets added during Aseret Yemei Tshuva over the period before? Every day we add an extra slicha, which is called an akedah. And we invoke the schut of Avraham at the akedah. Where did all that come from? Where did that literature come from? That literature came from France and Germany in the 12th and 13th centuries. That's what was writing this. Do you know why? This is terrifying. We're going to bring it back to Midrash. Because when the Crusaders were coming through the small Jewish towns and the bigger Jewish towns, in Northern Europe, on their way to rid the infidel from the Holy Land. What were they doing? And Jews knew in advance what was happening. What were the Crusaders doing? They're killing the men, having their way with the women, and then killing them. And then, what would they do with the children? They would take them and baptize them. Fathers, some fathers, took their children to the Rhine River, and slaughtered them in advance of the Crusader hordes. I cannot imagine even being faced with such a decision, much less having to make that decision. But we have record of it. We have record of a question being asked of the Marach or Zaruah, do you make a bracha on the Shechita? Imagine how terrifying this is. And every father who stood there at the Rhine River with a knife in hand and his young son or young daughter in his hand saw himself as Avraham at the Akedah. But it doesn't start there. It starts much earlier. And these are the seeds of it. There's a story told, there's several versions of it. In one version, the woman's name is Hannah. In another version, she doesn't have a name. A woman and her seven sons. They're all brought before the Roman governor, who has an idol there, and says to the first son, bow down. He won't bow down. Quotes a pasuk, kills the son. On and on and on. Finally, the youngest son. The governor says, look, I'm going to drop my keys. Just pick them up to make it look like you're bowing. You don't have to really bow. And the youngest son has some very sharp rebuke for this governor. So what a wuss you are. And the governor's about to kill him, and the mother says, give me 1 minute with my son. And listen carefully to the words she uses. When you get there, go tell Avraham Avinu, you were willing to sacrifice one son, I sacrificed seven. She kisses him, and that's the end of the story, almost. It's a terrifying story, but it's a heroic story. Because what the enterprise of the Midrash is, we see it in Haman's words in a whole different vein. We see it in what Rabbi Yochanan says with Hakol Kol Yaakov. The enterprise and the very successful enterprise of the Midrash is to ensure that the characters in Tanakh, both heroes and villains, remain alive. They are 3D living characters. What was the most popular Haman costume in Israel in 1991? A Saddam Hussein mask. You know what the most popular Haman costume was in Munich in 1938? A little mustache. when the Haganah was developing its playbook, especially in the 1940s. It took it right out of Sefer Yehoshua and Shoftim. The night raids, the noise, all of the tactics, straight out of there. And what were secular Israelis naming their kids? Yehoshua, Gideon, Ehud, great popular names, right out of Tanakh, because these people are alive. It's something Am Yisrael understands. And it's something the Midrash gives voice to. Over the past 3 weeks, we've been studying about Yaakov and Esau, the history of a conflict. We started by looking at the two people, Yaakov and Esau, and how their conflict really, as people, was resolved amicably. But the nevuah is ringing in the back of our head. Last week we looked at how that conflict plays out in biblical history. And ultimately finds its most ugly expression in the role that the Edomim played in the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. We find in Tehillim and in Eicha. But all of that pales next to what happens in the Midrash. Esav of the Midrash, the man Esav in the Midrash, is a murderer, is a savage, is a man with hatred that seethes and can never die. And if you come up to the Baal HaMidrash and say, but wait a second, Esav in Bereshit looks like kind of an impetuous youth, he'd say, yeah, that's okay. I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about that Esav. I'm talking about the Roman. I'm talking about the person who gets up in the mosque with a blade, you probably all saw the video, and shows people how to knife Jews. This happened 2 weeks ago. I'm talking about the man who is, or the people who are developing a murderous weapon and telling us that they're aiming it at us. Yaakov and Esav, the people, lived, died, and ended up actually with an amicable separation. Yaakov and Esav, the nations, Yaakov being us, and Esav, whoever it is who's out there with that hatred, that undying hatred for us, sadly and unfortunately, is a reality that's part of our history. And there are three words that push us on and on and on. The three words are, Rav Ya'avod Sayyid. That ultimately they will be brought to their knees. And ultimately we who represent HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who represent Chesed and Emet and Tzedek in this world, will be able to plant our flag on their back. Hopefully they'll be able to stand up and accept the flag, if not, not. Just a few closing notes. These shiurim have been a delight for me. First of all, I love coming to Chicago. A lot of old friends and some new friends. But they've also been a real honor. I don't want to embarrass Caleb because I know he doesn't like to be in the limelight. But I have in my life a very, very small select group of heroes. And two of them are young men. And they're heroic, unlike Rav Lichtenstein and other heroes that I have. Not for what they have accomplished, but for one very simple thing. A smile. The ability to take what life brings you as a challenge and a smile. One of my heroes who suffered terribly, you'd ask him how he's doing, and his answer always was, day by glorious day. Which was his translation of Baruch Hashem Yom Yom. To be able to stand up and to smile, to learn together, to daven together, is a surefire piece of a refuah. But you got to know, Caleb, you're giving every one of us so much chizuk just by being who you are. So thank you. And should be a refuah shlema for Yisrael Yehuda and Dina Sara. And Mirza Hashem, our learning should also serve to be another iron dome to protect Achein of Achiyotein of Meretz Yisrael. And indeed, we should see the time very soon. Thank you very much.